Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jerry Lubinow, Managing Editor of the California Journal of Politics and Policy at the Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California, and I'll be your moderator for today's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's guests, distinguished veterans journalists Dan Baltz and Hayne Johnson, who have written a new book entitled The Battle for America 2008, The Story of an Extraordinary Election. First, let me tell you a little bit about these two men, if I may. With the publication of The Making of the President in 1960, Theodore White invented a new genre of political reporting. It was my thought, he modestly wrote, that though later historians would tell the story of the quest for power in 1960 in more precise terms, with greater wealth of established fact, there might be some permanent value in the effort of a contemporary reporter to catch the mood and the strains, the weariness, elation, and uncertainties of the men who sought to lead America. While White had the field pretty much to himself, presidential campaign books have since become something of a cottage industry. And while the goals that White set remain unchanged, accomplishing them has become increasingly difficult as the number of people covering presidential campaigns has ballooned, along with the outlets available to them and the emergence of a 24-hour news cycle. On this mountain of information and analysis, our guests sit somewhere near the top, if not at the peak. Before taking over as the lead political reporter for the Washington Post, Dan Baltz was the paper's White House correspondent, national editor, and political editor. He has covered politics for 27 years. Hayne Johnson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of 14, now 15 books, this is old information, six of them national bestsellers. He holds the Knight Chair in Journalism at the University of Maryland. Their book is based on 2 years of reporting that includes exclusive interviews with President Obama, Senator John McCain, and the top advisors to all the major candidates. The result, far beyond what Phil Graham once referred to as a first rough draft of history, is something very close to the final word. Please welcome Dan Baltz and Hayne Johnson. Hayne, would you like to start?
Yes, thank you. I'm very glad to be here. I love this audience. This is why you write books. You want to be with people who could turn out, who are interested, who have questions for us, and that's really why we do this. I want to tell you what we tried to do in this project. And I'm glad you mentioned Teddy White. He was a friend of mine, and we did not start out to do a Teddy White book. And I say that nobody could quite do what Teddy did, but I thought Teddy was, with all of his strengths, and he was sort of a romantic about politics. I don't think this is a romantic campaign or a romantic time for the country, but we did try to capture the narrative of a great election. It started in 2006 when I was looking ahead to this next election and thinking about what we might do. Not Dan and I were not colleagues on this project at the time, and how we might sort of form, because it seemed to me that this election coming up in 2008 had the potential of being the most important in my lifetime. I've covered every president since Eisenhower, okay? And not Lincoln, but that's I mean, you know, seen a lot of terrible ups and downs and all that. But for a lot of reasons, everything was up for grabs in this political system and in the country. The country was in trouble, was divided. It didn't matter where you went. It didn't matter whether you were a Democrat or Republican, a liberal or conservative, or the rest. People felt the country was in trouble. They didn't know what the answer was going to be, but they were looking for something better. The economy was about to tank in the background. You had all kinds of problems with the two wars taking place. The Bush presidency had dropped from the top rating ever, 90% approval rating, George W. Bush, after 9/11. 90%, the highest in the history of the Gallup poll until By the time the election started, he was down where Nixon was at that time. So everything was changing around us, and you had great issues before the country. And it seemed to me at that point, this was the background for a really historic look at our system, not just the candidates, not just the political parties, not just the press, although that's all that, but also it would be a test of the people and our system. Are we up to making these kinds of changes in our country, in our system, or not? And out of this process came Barack Obama, which was I just want to say one thing about that. I'm not trying to puff our book, although why not, you know. But seriously, but there are one of the most remarkable to me, and looking back on that, I hope you'll find this way. The final interview with Barack Obama in Chicago, 6 weeks after he became president, is quite, to me, extraordinary. I've never thought of any president talking in the terms he did. He had told us that I'm a storyteller. He was having difficulty with the campaign about during the debates and so forth, the short-term, quick, snappy answers. And he was a storyteller, and so the question was, how would you tell the story of your own election? And he said, it was a great novel. He said, it was filled with the most remarkable cast of characters, and I was not the most interesting character in the book you had. Then he starts naming them all, from Hillary to McCain to Reverend Wright to Bill Ayers to Sarah Palin to Joe the Plumber, all of these. He said it was a great American story. And he was right. For us as journalists, as writers, this was the story that we loved, yearned to try to write and capture. And I'll let Dan describe what else we were trying to do in this project.
Thank you, Haynes. I want to also extend my thanks to everybody for coming out today. It is delightful, obviously, to be in San Francisco on a lovely day, and to see all of you here, and to know instinctively that you have probably followed this election as closely as we did. I want to add a footnote to how this collaboration came about. Haynes called me in early February of 2007, and we had worked many years together at the Washington Post, and he said, I've got something I want to talk to you about. Can we get together this week? So we agreed to have breakfast the next morning, and I went home that night, and I said to my wife, Nancy, I said, well, Haynes called today, and he's got something he wants to talk about. And Nancy, without missing a beat, said, well, if it's about a book, just say yes. Haynes had written 14 books. I'd written one book. So we got together the next morning, and Haynes laid out what he just described to you, his concept for a book that he had in mind to write, and he was interested in a collaborator. And I said, Haynes, it's amazing that you would come to me because I am two-thirds of the way through a book proposal of my own that is almost identical in scope, in concept, in breadth and depth, an idea as to exactly what you're talking about. And so the more we kind of hashed it out, the more it made sense to work together on it. And from there, we launched. At the end of a process like this, authors often say how difficult it was to write a book, how lonely it is to sit there in front of a computer every day and try to take all this material and turn it into something sparkling, the lonely agony of the writer, the difficulty of a collaboration and all of that. Haynes and I agree on a lot of things, and one thing we definitely agree on, this was a labor of love. I mean, this was a great project to be part of. In many ways, we sort of felt privileged to be able to try to put in book form this story. The raw material was unbelievably interesting. Our challenge really was to try to produce a book that would live up to the raw material, but also to try to tell people things that they didn't know. I mean, this is a story, as I said, that everybody feels they know. They certainly know how it ended. They know a lot of the twists and turns. And our challenge was to provide fresh insights. And I want to take a few minutes to talk a little bit about the Barack Obama that we write about in this book. I think it is common in people's minds as you compress several years of American political history into a sort of a snapshot, to think of Barack Obama's path to the presidency as beginning on the day that he gave that quite remarkable speech at the Democratic Convention in Boston in 2004, and that it was, in essence, a straight ascending path that brought him to the Oval Office in January of 2009. And that's partly true. But the story that we tell of Barack Obama is the story of a candidate whose ups and downs were much more remarkable than simply the ups. And there are a lot of things about Barack Obama that you learn, as we did from going through the reporting on this book, that I think are applicable. When I finish, I want to read a couple of things from the interview that Haynes talked about that I thought were compelling at the time and highly relevant today in what he is doing as a leader as he tries to get through these very difficult times. Barack Obama is extraordinarily competitive. He told us, you know, that he thought the odds of him winning this election were maybe 25% to 30%, but as he said, that's not bad odds for somebody in my situation. He has fierce determination. He has great ambition. Nobody would have gotten into this race. I mean, nobody runs for president who doesn't have enormous overriding ambition. But certainly Barack Obama, given his circumstances, his unique circumstances, had the kind of ambition and drive that you have to have. But the Barack Obama who started out on the campaign trail in 2007 was almost in many ways nothing like the candidate who has become kind of the idealized, amazing orator, gifted speaker, person who creates tremendous passion among his followers. He had a very rough startup. And he went to a healthcare forum in Las Vegas in March of 2007. Hillary Clinton was there. John Edwards was there. John Edwards gave a very strong presentation and had a clear healthcare plan that he put on the table at that session. Hillary Clinton gave an even more impressive presentation. Obviously, her command of the healthcare issue is extraordinary. And she also understood her audience, and she understood what a presidential candidate should deliver to an audience at a forum like that. Barack Obama came in, had no plan to talk about, had a website that didn't even mention national healthcare, did not have any sense of what he really wanted to do. His idea was, well, I'm just going to go have a conversation with the moderator. And as he watched what unfolded that day, he realized that Hillary Clinton was performing at this level as a candidate, and he was performing at this level as a candidate. Through that spring, he was an unhappy candidate. He was physically exhausted. He very much missed his family back in Chicago. He was not used to the kind of attention that he was getting. David Axelrod had written him a memo in November of 2006, which is included in the book. And it is a strategy memo, and remarkably prescient in many ways. Talks about why Barack Obama was uniquely suited at that minute to run, to be the change candidate in what would be a change election. Why Hillary Clinton was strong but not unbeatable. But he also said to Obama in this memo, one of the questions I have about you is whether you are prepared for one of the things you dislike most, which is criticism. You are going to get an enormous amount of criticism through the course of this campaign, and I don't know whether you are, as he put it, Muhammad Ali or Floyd Patterson in your ability to take a punch. He said when you got into a scrap with Alan Keyes, who was Obama's woefully weak opponent in the 2004 Senate race, he said you flinched. He said the presidential campaign can be a proving ground for strength, but there is a question about whether you are prepared for what you're about to go through. And in those early stages, Obama clearly was not prepared for it. I mean, he talked to a friend about how exhausted he was by it and how he was not performing well. And it got to the point where his low morale was in danger of infecting the entire campaign. And in the late spring of 2007, Robert Gibbs went out to Iowa with him. Gibbs had been his press secretary through the 2004 campaign while in the Senate, obviously now the White House press secretary, and had the kind of relationship with Obama in which when Obama needed to vent, Robert Gibbs was the designated ventee, but also knew how to talk back to Obama in those moments. And he said to Obama that morning, he said, find something positive about this campaign. I know you're unhappy about a lot of what's going on. Obama was unhappy with himself. He was unhappy with his staff, who he thought sat back in Chicago and, you know, critiqued his performances by long distance and didn't have to get up every morning and do what he had to do. He was unhappy with almost every element of the campaign except fundraising. And he said to Gibbs, "There is nothing at this point that I actually feel positive about with this campaign." Well, sitting over at the side is Reggie Love. Reggie is President Obama's personal assistant. Big, tall, strapping young guy who played basketball at Duke. Delightful guy. And Reggie's working his BlackBerry and listening to this conversation. And he looks up and he pipes up and he says, "Well, boss, if it's any consolation to you, I'm having the time of my life." And Obama looked back at him and he said, "Well, Reggie, it's not any consolation." And that was the mood and mindset for Obama in the course of the campaign. It took him a long time to get his sea legs as a candidate, to become comfortable as a debater, to get that kind of drive and aggressiveness that you need, and in particular to figure out his message. And what we saw through the course of particularly the difficult fight with Hillary Clinton is a candidate who would rise to big moments but at other times would perform at a much lower level. He is, in the parlance of pro basketball, a fourth quarter player. And he can coast from time to time and he can get unhappy with things and he can kind of appear distracted. But at the moments when it was required most, he was able to rise to the level that he needed. And I think the story, particularly of the Democratic primaries, which in many ways is the kind of the heart and soul of this election because of the intensity of it, the unexpected nature of it, the twists and turns, and the size of the characters involved in the fight. He and his campaign performed well when it counted most, and Hillary's campaign performed well when it counted least. And I think that was the main reason that he survived that. Then the general election is a campaign, and we can talk about some of this in the Q&A, particularly some of the Republican side of it and Sarah Palin, in which it was his to lose. He had to overcome two major question marks. The first was, who is Barack Obama? Is he one of us? Does he fit somehow into the American story, or is he too exotic for those people who still had some reservations about him and, frankly, a lot of misinformation about him? Could he overcome that? He was able to do that, certainly. The second was, did he have the strength, did he have the toughness to pass the threshold of being commander-in-chief? Not that he could outdo John McCain on that, but that if he simply could cross that threshold, they could put that issue to rest. He was, again, able to do that. And finally, what sealed the election, obviously, was the collapse of the economy and John McCain's very wobbly performance in a 10- or 12-day period between September 15th and the first debate in Mississippi, in which Barack Obama outperformed him. I want to go back and read you two things from the interview from 2008, from December. And for this reason, everybody now looks at President Obama and wonders what next, what's the next chapter of this story, will he succeed on health care, how is he approaching this, what's his mindset. There are two relevant pieces from the interview from December. The first has to do with essentially his view of how do you interpret the election. And one of the questions asked was, did he believe that the election marked the end of the Reagan era? This is an important question in part to think through how Obama would be approaching a lot of the questions of how much government is America prepared to accept. He knew the economy was going down. The day of the interview was a day in which he was told by his economic advisors that the economy was actually much, much worse than they had thought. It, in fact, became much worse even after that. So the question was this the end of 30 years of conservative ascendance? Did this bring back, was this the ushering in of a new progressive era? And he said, "What Reagan ushered in was a skepticism toward government solutions to every problem, a suspicion of command and control, top-down social engineering. I don't think that has changed. I think that's a lasting legacy of the Reagan era and the conservative movement starting with Goldwater. I do think what we're seeing is an end to the knee-jerk reaction toward the New Deal and big government. I think what you saw in this election was people saying, yes, we don't want some big bureaucratic, ever-expanding state. On the other hand, we don't want a state that is dysfunctional, that doesn't believe in its mission, that can't carry out some of the basic functions of government and provide services to people and be there when they're hurting. And so what I think you're seeing is a correction to the correction. What we don't yet know is whether my administration and this next generation of leadership is going to be able to hew to a new, more pragmatic approach that is less interested in whether we have big government or small government, but is more interested in whether we have a smart, effective government. I think that is still one of the biggest issues on the table for the future of the Obama presidency. He has not fully resolved those questions in people's minds as to the size and shape of government that he is asking people to accept between the economy and healthcare and climate change. He is asking people to accept an enormous amount of government, a significant rise in the deficit, some potentially serious long-term problems with the debt and deficit. But that is his perspective on it. The last question of the interview was, and this was Haynes's idea. Haynes said, ask about Lincoln. We have to ask about Lincoln because obviously, you know, he had started his campaign at the old State House in Illinois in Springfield, which is where Lincoln gave his House Divided speech. So the question was, in what ways is Lincoln a role model for you as a leader, and what does that mean? He said, and this was quite interesting, he said, Lincoln's my favorite president and one of my personal heroes. And then he paused, and he said, I have to be very careful here that in no way am I drawing equivalence between my candidacy, my life expectancy, or what I face, and what he went through. He said, I just want to put that out there so you don't get a bunch of folks saying I'm comparing myself to Lincoln. Then he paused and he said, what I admire so deeply about Lincoln, number one, I think he's the quintessential American because he's self-made. The way Alexander Hamilton was self-made, or so many of our great iconic Americans are, that sense that you don't accept limits, that you can shape your own destiny. He said, that obviously has appeal to me given where I came from. That American spirit is one of the things that is most fundamental to me, and I think he embodies that. And then he went on, and I think this is so revealing when you think about the criticism now of Obama from some people, particularly his most passionate supporters in the progressive community who want him to take the fight even more vigorously to his critics. He went on to say, what I admire most in Lincoln is that there is just a deep-rooted honesty and empathy to the man that allowed him to always be able to see the other person's point of view and always sought to find that truth that is in the gap between you and me. That the truth is out there somewhere, and I don't fully possess it, and you don't fully possess it, and our job then is to listen and learn and imagine enough to be able to go to that truth. If you look at his presidency, he never lost that, he said of Lincoln. Most of our other great presidents, there was that sense of working the angles and bending other people to their will, FDR being the classic example. Then he went on and he said, and Lincoln just found a way to shape public opinion and shape people around him and lead them and guide them without tricking them or bullying them, but just through the force of what I just talked about, that way of helping to illuminate the truth. I just find that to be a very compelling style of leadership. It's not one that I've mastered, but I think that's when leadership is at its best. Now, that gives you, I think, an insight into the Obama you are seeing as president as he tries to, particularly at this moment, guide the health care bill into a safe landing. We don't know what the next chapter of this Obama story will be. Our story ended on Election Day and Inauguration Day. There's another great story to be written about him, and we will, at this point, leave that to others. I want to turn it back to Haynes for a few other comments.
Well, just to follow up on that wonderful interview, the thoughtfulness of it and the sort of poignancy of it, that you can bring people together, that you can reason with them, you can get in their heads, and you won't have the vicious polarization that is now even worse than it was in the election. We're surprised in how quickly we have gone back into this hate cycle. And Obama's challenge, and it's even greater now than it was during the campaign, is can he do what he said then to bridge these differences through reason, through strength, yes, but reason, and succeed? That's a question we can't answer today, but that's the challenge for him. Just a couple of other things about before we get to questions. And this was such a great story to try to write. The cast of characters was not just a great novel. The characters were incredible. The Hillary, Bill, the Bill, Ted, Kennedy, the conflicts, the McCain up and down. Sarah Palin, my God, I mean, it just was a godsend for a writer. You don't want to have better characters. And you couldn't tell from day to day, just when we thought it was going to be over, something else happens. And I just, one thing we forget, here it is, September 17th, this time just a year ago. A couple of days before that, the economy was beginning to tank. But up until that point, coming after the Democratic convention in Denver, where we were, and many of you probably were too, at that convention, at that point, the Obama people were absolutely certain they were going to win. They were surging forward, and the McCain people believed the same thing. They were doomed. They couldn't see what... That's how they picked Sarah Palin, that to shake it up. Particularly a woman, we could bring in the Hillary people disaffected from so forth and so on. They thought that was going to be the way. And for 2 weeks, actually, all of a sudden, the surge went up. And by mid-September, John McCain was actually pulling ahead of Barack Obama in the polls. We've forgotten that, many of us have. And then, of course, the economy crashes. Sarah Palin's in flames from her interviews. It was over. And now the next story begins. What does he do with his presidency? And we'll take your questions.
Our thanks to veteran journalists Dan Baltz and Hayden Johnson, authors of the new book, The Battle for America 2008, The Story of an Extraordinary Election. It's time now for our audience question period to begin, and we have a number of questions, so let's begin. We have a number of questions that deal with the dynamics of the campaign. And one of them is, what was the single greatest impact of the 2008 election on the fundamental dynamics of political campaigns? But we were talking earlier about how everyone seems to be focused on sort of what's happening right now instead of how we got to where we are. And if I could just expand on this a little bit to have you talk a bit about how things have changed, say, in the last couple of cycles in terms of what impacts the coverage and what kind of things you have to take into consideration, and then what was specific to this one.
Yeah. Well, I think this is the campaign that truly did usher in the internet era into American politics. We've been barreling toward it, but this was the campaign where I think it fully flowered. We are in a much different, obviously it's cliche, a much different media environment. And it has affected the way campaigns operate, and it has affected the way the press covers campaigns, not always for the better. The goal in campaigns now is to create a narrative and to control a narrative. And campaigns, I've always said that campaigns know more about how the press does its business than the press knows about how campaigns do their business. They're always a cycle ahead of us in figuring this out. And in this campaign, the goal was to leverage small pieces of information and to make them a larger piece of the narrative that was most effective for your side and most destructive for the other side. We have now a political conversation which I think talks more and more about less and less sometimes, that we get fixated on the conversation of the minute as opposed to the conversation of the hour or the day or the week or the month or the year. We were talking before we came on that, you know, the conversation now is, you know, what happened 5 minutes ago and what may happen, you know, 5 days from now, as opposed to sort of how did we get here. So it is not an environment in which there is much time for thought or consideration or deep analysis. This gives an advantage to a campaign that is very aggressive and it is very deft and that understands the rules. And I think all of the campaigns knew how to do this to some extent, but there's no question, particularly in the general election, that there was a mismatch between the Obama campaign and the McCain campaign in their understanding of and their ability to exploit this new media.
And the Obama campaign understood the rules of politics today, caucus versus primary states. Stunningly, the Hillary people did not. They just booted it. So Obama ran a flawless campaign going after the small states and independents, so forth, and they prevailed in a way. It's stunning that the Hillary people did not do that. That was their great failure.
We have a couple of fairly specific questions about events in the campaign. If Obama had won the New Hampshire primary, do you think Hillary would have been done? And has too much power been given to these first two or three primaries?
Well, certainly, if Obama had won New Hampshire, it would have been over. And absolutely. And in fact, they thought they were going to win. And the question about the focus of early primaries versus the rest, we disagree on that. I would like to see regional primaries, five maybe, and so you don't have just one state dominating the process. Dan likes the caucus states and the primary states, but clearly the system is way too long, way too expensive, and it erodes interest and so forth. And it's just a problem.
I think Haynes is right. If Obama had won New Hampshire, he probably would have won more easily, although I don't think he would have emerged as good and as strong a candidate. I think that loss in New Hampshire ultimately was a blessing for him, and I think they came to recognize that, too.
And he did, too.
Yes. Yes. I mean, he recognized it on the night of the election. I mean, he said to some of his friends that night in New Hampshire, you know, it was going to be too easy, and this is actually probably good for us. But he also made a comment, paraphrasing Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a struggle. And he knew that they were in for a long struggle. My view of the process is that it is too long, obviously too expensive, but I don't think there is a simple way to deal with that. The reason I like some of these early states is that it does force candidates to get to know voters and to take the voters' wrath and questions face-to-face. And if you lose that, you lose, I think, an essential quality of our democracy. If you do what Haynes is talking about, and I think there are some good reasons to do the kind of thing that Haynes is talking about, a series of regional primaries, what you then end up with is a playing field that is even more strongly tilted toward the candidate of the big name and of big money. I don't think Barack Obama would be president today if we were operating under that system. Now, for people who are unhappy that Barack Obama is president today, they'd say, well, then change the system. But Iowa was absolutely critical. There's a fundamental difference in the way the Obama campaign and the Clinton campaign approached Iowa. For Obama, Iowa was the prism through which they saw the rest of the campaign. And for Clinton, the national campaign was the prism through which they played in Iowa. And that is, it's fundamentally important because the Obama campaign poured everything into Iowa, almost to the exclusion of every other state, whereas the Clinton campaign treated Iowa as, yes, the first and very important state, but only one of many. And it meant that Obama was able to do things in Iowa and to build an organization and to get himself grounded in ways that Hillary Clinton was never able to do.
Well, let me just add one thing. There's one thing about this. Looking back on the campaign, we talk in the book about the what-ifs of history. What might have happened? For instance, if Michigan and Florida had been able to vote instead of being sanctioned not to participate, and the Obama people recognized this, as a matter of fact, that she probably would have been the nominee of the Democratic Party. So it's an extraordinary. The election had so many turns. No Democratic candidate who became a nominee who failed to win those big states. And Hillary won New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Texas, et cetera, California. And that is the background to be the nominee, not this last year, because they understood, the Obama people, the real arithmetic of the caucus and states, and they won it brilliantly. And every campaign from now on will study what they did.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our speakers today are Dan Baltz, lead political reporter of the Washington Post, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Haynes Johnson, who are here discussing their new book and the long-term impact of the 2008 election. Let's get back to the campaign itself just briefly. I have some number of questions about Sarah Palin, which we can deal with later. But we also have some questions about the McCain campaign, the financial problems they had, his decision when the financial circumstances hit to suspend his campaign and then to not suspend his campaign. If he had run a smooth campaign, if he not had, talk a little bit about the background behind those things, but also could he have won this against Obama?
I think it would have been enormously difficult for John McCain to win this election for this reason. He was the nominee of a party whose incumbent president was somewhere below 30% in approval rating. He was the nominee of an incumbent presidency at a time when consumer confidence was plummeting. And when the polling question, do you think the country's generally going in the right direction or has gotten seriously off track, was heading up to record levels of people thinking the country was off track. This was an environment in which people were hungering for a change. Wasn't always clear exactly what the change was. People would disagree on what that was. But essentially to be a candidate who was fairly or unfairly tagged as running for a third term of George W. Bush was an impossible situation to be in. The more remarkable story about John McCain is that he ended up as the Republican nominee at all. I mean, he obviously started out as the favorite, not an overwhelming favorite, but the favorite. He would have been a more overwhelming favorite for the nomination had he stronger ties to the Republican base, but he was always somebody who the base saw as, you know, a rogue, if you will. But he started out in the dominant position, and they built a campaign in which that was their goal, to become a Bush-like campaign, big organization, lots of money. That campaign imploded, as you recall, in June and July of 2007, and he was in a terrible strait. I mean, Haynes likes to recall that when McCain returned to New Hampshire after the implosion, instead of a chartered plane, he was flying commercial. Instead of an entourage, he had one aide, and he carried his own bag. His ability to survive through those long, tough months of July, August, September, October, November, to put himself in a position to be able to win the New Hampshire primary was really a remarkable story of survival and also a remarkable story of ineptitude and incompetence on the part of his opponents.
Just one thought about McCain. Dan said early on when we were looking at McCain, he used the metaphor of the Shakespearean tragedy. He said he is trapped in something that he can't escape from. That is, he was the prisoner of war who suffered and survived, became an American hero, genuinely, legitimately, and then he is crushed by George Bush in 2000, after he beat Bush in New Hampshire, crushed him in South Carolina on the pro-war sentiment and so forth. But he then finds himself 8 years later having to defend the policies of the man who beat him because he believed in that war, but he couldn't extricate himself from it. He was again a prisoner of war.
Sarah Palin. We have a number of questions about Sarah. Why don't we just sort of address it broadly, talk some about her selection and what that said about the campaign, how that affected the campaign, how her handling of herself during the campaign affected it, how her relationship to the base affected him. And what you might think of her future.
The selection of Sarah Palin is one of the most fascinating parts of the research we did for this book. She was really not on anybody's radar screen early on, including the McCain campaign, at least not in any serious way. There were some conservatives who were impressed with her and thought she had a future in conservative Republican politics, but very few people took her seriously as a prospective candidate. Things turned in the period of July and particularly early August in the McCain campaign. They were afraid that Barack Obama was literally going to lock up the election in July. And as they got nearer to the picking a vice presidential nominee, it was their feeling that unless they did something dramatic to literally change the dynamic of the election, there was no way they could win. Steve Schmidt said to one of the others, if we can run a perfect campaign, and if we don't shake this up, we're going to lose this thing. So at that point, they turned much more seriously to Sarah Palin as one of the potential candidates. There were others. Joe Lieberman obviously was one. McCain was very attracted to him. They even talked to Lieberman about the ticket taking a one-term pledge. They would, if they got elected, they would agree to serve only one term in Washington, and then they would turn it over to somebody else and let somebody else come in. But ultimately, they were drawn to Palin for, I think, three reasons. The first, as I say, was to shake things up, the element of surprise, do something dramatically different. Second, that she was a woman. They were not doing well. McCain was not doing well among women voters. Their hope was that Sarah Palin might be able to attract some of the women, particularly some of the women who had voted for Hillary Clinton, who might be disaffected by what had happened in the Democratic race. I think that obviously was a flawed strategy, but nonetheless, it contributed to the decision. The third and I think most important reason was that McCain saw in Sarah Palin something of a soulmate. And I say that in this way. When she got elected governor of Alaska, she beat the incumbent governor in the primary. She was somebody who went against the Republican establishment in Alaska. And that Republican establishment included people that John McCain had tangled with in Washington, particularly Ted Stevens. McCain badly wanted to get back to the idea to be able to project to people that he was the candidate who would actually shake up Washington, that Barack Obama might be calling himself the change candidate, but this was a guy who had never really taken on a tough fight. McCain had, but he needed something to reinforce that image. And on the morning of the selection, McCain is on the phone with A.B. Culverhouse, who was the former White House counsel under Reagan and ran the vice presidential selection process. Culverhouse had interviewed her the night before by telephone. She was already in Arizona. And he was giving McCain a readout. McCain said, bottom line, A.B., what is it? And A.B. said, John, high risk, high reward. And McCain said, A.B., you shouldn't have told me that. I've been taking risks all my life. And on that basis, she arrived. He talked to her for an hour, and he picked her, and I'll let Haynes pick up the story from there.
Well, the meteor of, we all know the meteor, took off. The Republicans loved her. All of a sudden, they were energetic. They were the most discouraged group I've ever seen covering politics when I went to the Republicans that first day before Sarah spoke. They knew they were going to lose, dispirited, and then came Sarah. Wow, you know, and turned on the voters across the country, at least Republican base. The problem was that while she was appealing and so forth to the Republican base, women were insulted by the idea that this is the person that you're picking. And furthermore, they vetted her for any scandals, but not for the possibility of being competent to be president of the United States. And the country saw that. And the Katie Couric interviews were devastating, as we all know. And, of course, that coincided with the fall of the economy and so forth, and that was it. About her future, she's going to make a lot of money. That's all I'll say.
We have a number of questions relating to what's happened since the campaign. There was a lot of talk during the campaign about a postpartisan era, and Obama was talking about overcoming the sort of hostility and the sentiment in Congress and in the country. That doesn't seem to have happened. Could you talk about that some, and also in specific relationship to how he's handled the health care issue?
Well, the postpartisan era nationally has worked about as well as the postpartisan era here in California, I would say, just to say not at all. I think that the Obama team was probably surprised by how quickly the country repolarized after the election. I think their view, certainly in December and early January, was that because of what had happened in the election, because he had gotten, first time since Lyndon Johnson that any Democrat had gotten more than 50.1% of the vote. 53% is not a huge mandate, but it is a significant shift from where the politics of the country had been. I think they looked at that, and then they looked at the state of the country and the size of the problems, particularly the economy, and believed that at least in the early stages of the presidency, there would be a greater likelihood that Republicans would cooperate on finding a way out of the recession and dealing with some of the other big issues that they wanted to take on. And they learned early on that that was not to be. People can debate as to whether it is the Republicans' fault for simply deciding that it was in their best interest to essentially oppose everything that Obama wanted to do, or that it was that Obama talked about and Democrats talked about cooperativeness but did not genuinely engage with Republicans on how you do these things. But it has created, as Haynes said, a virulence now in our politics again that I think it's going to take an even longer amount of time to unwind. How Obama will work his way out of this, we don't know. I mean, all presidents talk about or often talk about wanting to unite the country. Obviously, George W. Bush did. Once they are in office, a different ethic sort of takes hold, and that is they realize they have to produce results. If Obama is successful in turning economy around, if he is successful first in enacting a health care plan and second putting that into place in a way that people say this is better and different than what we had before, then in some ways for his own political future it won't matter that the country is still polarized. And so his first goal at this point is to get things done and hope that what he is pushing through has an effect that's positive for the country, which then would be positive for him.
Jerry, going back to why we did this book in the beginning, when we were looking ahead to 3 years when we started talking about it, the idea, it seemed absolutely clear to us, no matter who was going to be president of the United States, in 2008 was going to have one of the most difficult, challenging times in our history, maybe since Roosevelt in 32, maybe since Lincoln in 1860, because the issues were so intractable and so divisive. So no matter who was going to be sitting in the White House, there would be terrible difficulties to bring the country. Obama's hope was you could reason your way through the differences and so forth. That remains the test now. It's even clearer that those problems are even more intractable and divisive, and it's a real challenge for us. And I hope that the lessons that we tried to draw here have some relevance to where it is. Certainly Obama's words do. It's quite poignant to go back and hear what he hoped to achieve and where he is today. And just one last, personally. I mean, I've covered politics, and we have both. I've never seen the degree of hatred, the violence, and the people showing up with automatic weapons and so forth at a rally with the President of the United States. It's just extraordinary. That's not the heart of America, I don't believe at all. But it is getting great coinage through the 24/7 news media, as that is the test of the country. Yes, people are frustrated, they're anxious, they're concerned about all these other issues, and that's going to be the next time of testing is going to be very severe.
Let's pursue that a bit. And there's been talk recently about racial overtones in some of the things that are going on. To what extent do you think that's true?
Well, let me take a whack at that first. I do not believe that the country is now stepping back in the racial hatreds of 40, 50 years ago when I used to cover civil rights and saw people clubbed to death just to march from here to that wall to register to vote. We're not in that state. But the anger, the frustration, the virulence is there. There's no question that it's there. Obama's whole idea of being a post-racial candidate is trying to overcome that, is part of one of the reasons he won. And I think if we all look back to the inauguration, to the election night in Grant Park, there was a feeling, and I think genuinely, across the country, wherever you were, a Democrat or Republican, didn't matter, there was a sense of pride that the United States had moved beyond and electing someone named Barack Hussein Obama, African-American president. It was a matter of pride for the country and signaled a better time for the country, more healing time. Is it still true? I don't know.
I would say this. I think that if you look at it from the perspective of Obama and the White House, as Haynes said, that there's certainly still racial prejudice in this country. And for some people who may be opposing Obama, that may be it. I watched a focus group that Peter Hart conducted before the election in which there were a number of people, all independents, all undecideds at that point. And there was one particular person who, by all measure, should have been voting for Obama and was not voting for Obama. And Peter, who is extraordinarily skilled as a focus group moderator, kept coming back to her to try to sort of pull out of her what's the real reason. And she could never articulate it. And the assumption, I think, on the part of a lot of people around the room was it had something to do with race, but you couldn't pinpoint it, you couldn't prove it, but you sort of know that for some people that may be the truth. But I think that there is much more to the anger than race. And I think that the last thing that Barack Obama wants is a big conversation about, is this country back in a period of racial prejudice? As Haynes said, he wanted to be and has always sought to be a post-racial candidate, and that whenever he has talked about race, it is because he has been forced by circumstance and the politics of the moment to do so. He did not give a speech on race, as he thought about doing through much of the campaign, until we heard about Reverend Wright's sermons. He held the famous beer summit after the incident in Cambridge, not to begin a conversation on race, but to get himself out, to extricate himself from a political problem he had created by attacking the Cambridge police over the arrest of Henry Louis Gates, Jr. Right now, as you can see, when Jimmy Carter raises the issue of race and suggests that much of the opposition to Obama is based on race, that Robert Gibbs, in the name of the president, said he disagrees. They will do everything they can not to force an engagement on this because they think that it is not healthy for the country, I believe, but also particularly not healthy for them politically in trying to do all of the other things they're doing. It is, in their estimation, a distraction. I think their view is that, yes, there may be some people who oppose Barack Obama because of race, but there also may be some people who support him because of race, not just African Americans, and that in the end that washes out or may in fact work as a slight advantage for him.
What about the opposition in Congress? Is that how much, maybe just focus specifically on the health care bill, to what extent is that opposition driven by genuine policy differences, by some ideology, or by the notion that some had suggested just to take down Obama and beat him on this?
Well, certainly one of the lessons of the election was the difficulty of the Republican Party having lost so many elections and seeing the changes in the country electorally. The country has moved, and Obama won because of the support of young voters, women voters, African-American voters, Latinos. Across the board, the country was moving away from the Republican Party that existed, was a majority party during the Reagan periods and beyond. So the demographics, all of these elements suggested the Republicans were really a party of the South, mainly evangelical, white, the faces. You looked in the faces in the speech to the Congress. All the Republicans, these white faces. They're not a single black face there, and very few Latinos and so forth. So from the Republican standpoint, strategically, politically, they had a problem. And the problem was, how do you regain control? They regained control of the Congress, of the House, rather, in the Clinton health care plan. And the health care plan is enormously controversial. It's divisive. We all know it. Everybody agrees something needs to be done, but how do you agree on what is to be done? And it's taken too long to get it forward, and it's still going on. So all of that, the elements were there for assaulting and divisiveness in our politics, and we'll see what happens. But the Republican Party, either it further diminishes its standing in the country or has a rebirth. We'll see.
I would say a lot of the opposition is philosophically based. I mean, there is a deep philosophical divide between the Republicans and the Democrats over the issue of health care. The Republicans look at the Obama plan, put aside whether you can't entirely put aside the public option debate, which I think has assumed an even greater centrality in the debate than it deserves. But this is a plan that inserts government into the healthcare system of the United States in ways that it isn't at this point. And for a lot of Republicans, that is anathema to the way they see how you should solve problems. Certainly, there is a political element to the opposition. I mean, the first step for the Republican revival is for Barack Obama to stumble and fall. That is the way that many parties come back from big defeats, that there is some turn in the politics of the country. You know, 4 years ago, we would have been sitting here talking about the likelihood or the prospect of a durable Republican majority in this country for the foreseeable future. And yet, within a very short space of time, because of a turn in public opinion against George W. Bush over the war in Iraq, and then Katrina, and then disillusionment within the Republican Party over whether he was a true conservative on fiscal issues, the country underwent a significant change. That can happen again, but it can only happen, or it would be aided in the Republican view if Barack Obama runs into problems. And the longer and stronger that they can become in opposing him and creating doubt in the minds of swing voters, those independent voters who may have voted for Obama but are not wedded to the Democratic Party, the more they can engender doubt among those voters, the more likely they are to do well in 2010. And if they do well in 2010 and the economy is still struggling, then we'll see what happens in 2012.
The danger for the Republicans is if they are tagged and the country believes it to be true, they are the party of no. That won't probably work well politically, but we'll see.
But to what extent are the problems that Obama is having on health care of his own making? There has been a lot of talk that he overreacted to Clinton's experience and didn't want to put something out, and so he threw it out to Congress, and then he sort of let it get away from him in August. And is part of this his own making?
Well, let me try to take – Dave Broder and I spent 4 years of our life running about the health care crisis in the Clinton years and talked to everybody and so forth. And the lessons of that point, that the Clintons tried to do too much within the White House, putting forward. And this time, Obama, looking at the process, decided not to do that. They will learn the lesson, and they will let Congress do it. That'll be the – and now nothing has yet been produced and so forth, so they are back and forth on this process. And I think there's – miscalculation did exist.
I agree with that. I think that – I think two things happened. One, as Haynes suggests, that the – that they gave – a very long leash to Congress, and Congress decided they wanted even more time and longer leash. And it dragged out the process of producing bills that could get to the floor of the House and Senate in a more timely way. So they're behind schedule. And in that period of time, it has allowed opponents to mount a much more vigorous opposition. The climate has certainly been different this time than last. I mean, the last time the opposition was in many ways led and financed by the industry. That has been much less the case this time. There is a combination of pure Republican opposition and what I would call a kind of a grassroots populism, which has a kind of an element of Perotism to it, which is tied up in these issues we've been talking about, the size of government, the future of the federal deficit, and what happened, I think, in August is that under the ideal timetable, there would have been votes in the House and the Senate on legislation. And at that point, the goal would have been for proponents of health care to go back and begin to say, in fairly simple terms, here's what we have on the table and here's why it will be good for you. And instead, because you had essentially a mishmash of competing legislation with lots of different provisions that opponents could pick on the most egregious things they could find in those measures, and they took control of the debate in August. And what you've seen since is that President Obama is now trying to re-seize control through the speech he gave last week. He's doing every Sunday morning talk show except Fox this coming Sunday in an effort to take back control of this.
We've had a number of questions about his policy toward Afghanistan. He's managed to draw down Iraq, and that seems to be sort of on a glide path, but he's seems to be strengthening his commitment to Afghanistan, and there is opposition to it among their members of his own party. Is that going to be more of a problem for him?
Afghanistan is a huge problem, and there's no question it is going to be one of the really telling symbols of his presidency, whether he succeeds or not. The idea of expanding and adding to the troop level, to what purpose, how long, what is coming in a backdrop of economic times and uneasiness about the government and all that, presents an enormous challenge for Barack Obama. And the country, the specter of Vietnam has been raised and so forth. Afghanistan is not a hospitable place to fight wars. The British Empire lost there. The Romans lost there. The Russians lost there. I won't give you a history lesson, but it's not terrific.
In some ways, what Obama is doing on Afghanistan is quite consistent with what he talked about in the campaign. Iraq was the bad war, but as he always said, the problem is that it took our eye off the ball from the real battle. And he said throughout the campaign that he was not a candidate who was a peacenik, who was against all war. He was against a bad war, and he characterized Iraq as such, but described Afghanistan in terms that George Bush talked about Iraq, the central front in the war on terror. And he has acted on both sides of that war issue as president, to draw down troops in Iraq, not as fast as some of his progressive supporters had hoped, but nonetheless, as Haynes said, the beginnings of a glide path to do that. He has augmented forces in Afghanistan. He has reoriented the strategy, and it's pretty clear that he's going to augment those forces significantly in the months ahead. That is dangerous for two reasons. One is obviously it is dividing his base of support. And he's going to get increasing amounts of opposition from within the Democratic Party over his Afghanistan policy. You can already see it in Congress. Russ Feingold talking about the need for a timetable for withdrawal. Does that sound familiar to anybody?
Carl Levin.
Greatly skeptical about it. So he is going to have to fight that battle through the Democratic Party. He's going to have to rely on Republican votes to get some of these war resolutions through. But then he's going to have to show that he has something other than an open-ended timetable for the U.S. commitment in Afghanistan, because it is that notion of an endless war that caused George W. Bush so much problem. You have to be able to prove that the strategy you're following has some chance for success sooner rather than later. And I think that at this point, that isn't clear on the horizon.
Obama was criticized early on for trying to take on too much and to do too many things at one time, and some of his other initiatives seem to have paled as he's focused more and more on health care and now Afghanistan. Some people were asking what happens with his leadership on climate change and some of the other issues that he pushed.
Well, the agenda is so overwhelmingly. Look at everything we've talked about here. We haven't even talked about climate change. He's got the economy first and foremost. Is it coming back? You know as well as I do. It looks better right now, but still unemployment is high. What California is going through is a staggering distress of cutbacks and so forth. I read this morning's paper, raising tuition, the University of California system, 32% next year and cutting down across the board. And this is not just California, it's across the country. So you've got all these problems that are on the president's plate agenda. And he's criticized maybe for trying to do too much, but I think you can't criticize if we're not trying to attend to some of them. And the question is, what are the priorities? Does it work? Can you demonstrate you have some success and then go on to the next area? Whether he should have focused everything intensely on the economy and then gone to health care and then done that, that's a debate you can have, but you can't have a debate that these problems don't need to be readdressed for the American future.
If he succeeds on health care, and I'm not predicting one way or the other, then I think the debate over whether he tried to take on too much will fade away. If he doesn't, we will have a debate right, or a discussion and a conclusion, frankly, that will be similar to the one that happened in the Clinton administration, which was, had they pushed welfare reform before they pushed health care, would the Democrats have lost the Congress in 1994 or not? These are these are wonderful, unanswerable questions, but I think that that will be on the table depending on how this health care fight comes out. I think climate change at this point is just going to get pushed into the background until there is a clear resolution of the health care fight. They've got to deal with that, and in the view of the White House and a lot of Democrats on Capitol Hill, they have to succeed on it. The failure is no option. And so they are going to find a way, if they possibly can, to get a bill through. What that bill looks like, whether it works.
But they can celebrate it as a great success, whether it is or not. You know, if you pass it, you're going to
declare victory and go home.
They'll be raising pens and say, hooray, you know.
There's also some questions about the role of the media. And we've seen an increase in the involvement of Saturday Night Live, Daily Show, Colbert, for the cover of your book, has a couple of those figures on it.
Tina Fey. Yes.
Tina Fey.
And Jon Stewart. And
of course, bloggers who are sort of working off what the working press does. How is that balance going to shift? And particularly, is there a concern as young voters become more important and more of them say that they get most of their news from comedians?
Well, yeah, I guess you're asking the wrong people here. We're old-time newspaper reporters who love the news business and are dismayed at what's been happening, not just to the diminution of the standing and the economics of it and the shutting down and shuttering of bureaus and cutting back, but the real tragedy for the country in the long run. Are you going to be able to get reporters that has influence of perspective, of analysis? Can you take the time to go spend a month or 2 months into one subject only and then produce it for? I worry about that. I don't have the answers. I wish I did, but I worry about it.
I don't know that people will get so much of their news from comedians, if you will. I mean, the role of late-night television has been a powerful force in American politics, predating Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. The late-night comedians have had an influence in shaping public opinion about major political candidates. We now have such a disparate environment of different voices, some somewhat more influential than others. But I think that we've so atomized the conversation that it's had a couple of effects. One is that people get information that conforms with their political views and can find it much more easily and seek it out much more aggressively, so that there is... It's in some ways easy to sort of insulate yourself from the other point of view in the country if you want to do that.
That's right.
You watch, Fox News on one hand or parts of MSNBC on the other, and you get two totally different views of the world.
And you repeat those slogans as if that's all there is.
Yeah. And it means that there is no one dominant voice in the conversation. That's probably healthy. But the question of how you pull the country together and make it more governable is, to me, the biggest concern about the media environment that we're in. It's not just the media environment, it's the cultural and political environment that we're in.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we only have time for one last question. Given the campaign and Obama's victory and the race that Clinton ran, what is it likely to say about the kind of candidates we're going to see in the future in presidential campaigns?
Well, Obama set a wonderful standard for political candidates. I mean, he understood better than anybody what the mood of the country was. The cliche is change. Every candidate and all our history talks about change. But he really understood that we were hungering for something different. And candidates are going to have to do that. I don't think the ideological warfare we're seeing now is going to be the wave of the future. I hope I'm right about that. I think the country wants serious attention, serious answers, dealt with seriously. And we'll see. And that's what he tried to do. Whether he succeeds or not, there's a great deal at stake.
There is a tendency sometimes to focus too much on the mechanics of why a campaign won. And there's been a lot of attention, and justifiably so, on all that the Obama campaign did with social networking and with building volunteers and all of that. I think that was an essential element of it. But I think Obama is like other successful candidates, and that it will be the watchword in the future. You have to have a real message. You have to have a message that resonates with people. You have to understand the moment the country is in. Only if you do that can you take advantage of all of the other things that a good campaign does, the fundraising, the organizing, the technology, the new media. But I think that the candidates in the future, as Haynes suggests, are going to be similar to the ones in the past who've been successful. They understand where the country is, and they have something important to say to people about their future.
Our thanks to veteran journalists Dan Baltz and Haynes Johnson, authors of the new book, The Battle for America, 2008, The Story of an Extraordinary Election. We also thank our audiences here and on radio and television and the Internet. I'm Jerry Lubinow, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you, Jerry. That was great.
Wonderful program. Thank you so much.